This is FSRN, the weekly edition. I'm Nell Abram. Coming up on this week's show, efforts to evacuate civilians from the last rebel-held enclave in Aleppo stall again as Syrian government forces take control of the area. The Wisconsin recount finished up ahead of schedule, ending the three-state effort. And renewed violence against ethnic Rohingyas in Myanmar's Rakhine State forces tens of thousands to flee their villages. Those stories and more on FSRN's Weekly Edition. Tens of thousands of people remained stranded in Aleppo Friday after an on-again, off-again mass evacuation halted. Syrian government forces, backed by foreign militias and Russian air power, took over nearly all of the large city's rebel-held areas in recent days in what may be a decisive turning point in the ongoing civil war. Opposing sides are trading blame for the sudden pause in the evacuations, while civilians are left in the lurch. It's unclear how many people made it out of the area before the operation was stopped. Estimates range from 3 to nearly 10,000. People purportedly trapped in eastern Aleppo have been uploading videos throughout the week. In footage released Friday, evacuees are seen first crowding the streets to leave and later returning from blocked exits.
It's heartbreaking for sending the last message for me from my the neighborhood that I used to live and report from and work from.
There are thousands upon thousands of men, women, and children that are here. The fighters were not allowed to leave. I repeat, they were not allowed to leave today, nor were their families.
These are the civilians that are coming back from the crossing point, from the passage, after it was closed, after Iranian militias and regime have breached the agreement. Still here in the besieged district, thousands of civilians who couldn't cross.
We asked to live in a free and democratic country, in a country that is for everyone. We asked for a free Syria. We asked to remove al-Assad. We don't want Syria in al-Assad's way. We want a free Syria. No one has supported us or even helped us. And as you can see, we are being kicked out of our city, out of Syria. I am the son of Aleppo, the son of Aleppo, the son of Syria. I will go out of Syria and I don't want to. I don't want to leave it.
There was no shortage of finger-pointing at the United Nations this week, with Western countries accusing Russia of blocking any and all meaningful attempts to find a non-military solution to the crisis. Aside from diplomatic sparring and words of condemnation, international powers have done little more than observe the siege and mass displacement unfold. Outgoing UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon addressed the issue Friday in his final press conference.
The carnage in Syria remains a gaping hole in the global conscience. Aleppo is now a synonym for hell. As I told the Security Council 3 days ago, we have collectively failed the people of Syria. Peace will only prevail when it is accompanied by compassion, justice, and accountability for the abominable crimes we have seen.
The eastern districts of Aleppo had been a Syrian opposition stronghold for nearly the entire duration of the conflict. The stasis was broken only after Russian military intervention. Multiple major news outlets reported this week that anonymous sources in the U.S. intelligence community allege Russia and even President Vladimir Putin himself were behind political cyber attacks during the recent election cycle. President Barack Obama has ordered an investigation. Members of the Electoral College and congressional lawmakers on both sides of the aisle have requested briefings. So far, intelligence officials have not publicly presented concrete evidence. But questions about the integrity of presidential elections abound. FSRN's Dave Goodman has more.
To enter the booth, the curtains are in a closed position. Part the curtains and step inside. Move the red handle all the way to the right and leave it there.
It is a bit archaic now, but the old-style mechanical voting booth did work. What seems to never go out of style, say critics, are policies and programs designed to reduce the number of citizens who can participate in elections, mostly in the name of preventing voter fraud. Immigration hardliner and Kansas Secretary of State Chris Kobach is an advisor to President-elect Donald Trump and in the running for a high-level administration post. As a guest on Newsmax TV in August, Kobach alleged that undocumented immigrants could be swinging elections.
25 aliens who either got on our voter rolls or attempted to get on our voter rolls after our proof of citizenship law went into effect in just one county. Well, we have 105 counties in Kansas. And, you know, you multiply that out proportionally to the state, we're talking about hundreds of aliens on our voter rolls.
We actually tested this. It's what led states to adopt, we call it restrictor voter access legislation.
Professor Erin O'Brien chairs the Political Science Department at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. Her research finds that partisanship, rather than voter fraud, is key to understanding why states pursue restrictive registration policies or legislation.
And there could be voter ID, shortening early voting, things like that. And, you know, the best predictors were partisanship, Republican control of the state legislature and governorship, and on top of that, where minority turnout had increased.
Of course, the U.S. has a history of blocking certain groups of people from exercising their right to vote. In recent years, and especially since the contested presidential election in 2000, reports of voter suppression have surfaced, using descriptions such as vote caging, scrubbing, and purging. But is there a so-called smoking gun? Rahsaan Hall thinks so. He's the director of the ACLU of Massachusetts Racial Justice Program.
In the recent case out of North Carolina, where the court struck down some of the changes to the voting laws, they said that you intentionally identified the measures that would impact the greatest number of people of color or African-American voters. Like, that was their rationale.
Investigative journalist Greg Pallast has been reporting on U.S. elections for years and authored the 2004 book, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, now out in comic book form and made into a movie. This year, Pallast focused his attention on something called the Interstate Cross-Check Program.
This voting system is out of control. You have people, in my opinion, that are voting many, many times.
Say what, Donald?
You have people, in my opinion, that are voting many, many times.
Reflecting Trump's claim of multiple voting Democrats, GOP-controlled states have purged nearly 1 million voters accused of voting or registering in two states.
Developed in Kansas under Secretary of State Chris Kobach, 30 states share their voter registration rolls, and Interstate Cross-Check compares first, middle, last names, as well as the last four digits of their Social Security number. When potential duplicates arise, local election officials remove the names and, in theory, prevent people from voting multiple times. But is the provided information comprehensive and accurate? And do those deletions result in fewer votes cast? Responding to a Free Speech Radio News email survey of the participating states, a spokesperson for West Virginia said her state dropped out in 2014 because data was, quote, not strong enough. When asked what that means, the spokesperson replied, "We could not determine that the records we received were voters on our list. For example, the names may have been close, but not close enough. We just were not confident in the data." Seven states responded to FSRN's survey by saying they have not seen any evidence of voter suppression or that critics don't understand the merits of voter roll maintenance. A spokesperson from Arizona called allegations of suppression baseless and inappropriate. But Bentley University professor and political scientist Jeff Gulati thinks partisanship is a factor in determining how states manage elections, and historical and modern attempts to limit participation overlap.
Democracy implies that you have very wide participation. Even if we're going to say the same parties would have won, there's still a legitimacy issue there.
While interstate cross-check isn't the only multi-state voter roll comparison, according to the Verify Voting Foundation, more than 7 million people appear on the list, and fewer than 5 have been accused of intentionally registering or voting twice. Dave Goodman, FSRN, Boston.
Jill Stein's three-state recount push is all but over, and the Green Party's 2016 candidate for president said Tuesday that any funds remaining will go to groups working for electoral reform and voting rights. Stein formally withdrew her request for a recount in Michigan Tuesday. A court ordered it halted last week after 2 days of tallying. In Pennsylvania, a judge ruled that the recount request came too late in the game and blocked the effort from advancing. And Monday evening in Wisconsin, Election Commission Chair Mark Thompson certified the recount ahead of schedule without any significant changes in the totals, just a net gain of 131 votes in Trump's favor.
That is accuracy, and that's what we offer in Wisconsin: fair, efficient, and honest elections, and that we don't count illegal votes, much less millions of illegal votes.
The Electoral College is set to vote Monday, where chances are slim enough votes will change to alter the projected outcome, even though updated tallies show Hillary Clinton won the popular vote by a margin of nearly 3 million. This week, President-elect Donald Trump added 3 more names to his passel of fossil fuel hawks nominated for cabinet positions. Joining Oklahoma Attorney General Scott Pruitt for the EPA are climate denier and Montana Republican Congressman Ryan Zink for the Department of Interior, ExxonMobil CEO Rex Tillerson for Secretary of State, and former Texas Governor Rick Perry, a board member of Energy Transfer Partners, to lead the Department of Energy, an agency he once vowed to destroy. Stoking concerns of an ideological purge at the Energy Department, the transition team asked for a list of staffers who've worked on climate change issues. So far, the department is refusing to comply. And several U.S. governors, mayors, and environmental justice advocates say there are ways to do an end run around potentially anti-climate policies of a Trump administration. FSRN's Larry Buell has more from Los Angeles.
The choices for Trump's cabinet and advisors have signaled that the incoming president could roll back gains like the Paris Accord and a bilateral U.S.-China climate deal, and fail to enforce EPA regulations, or even eliminate those regulations. But many U.S. governors and mayors are promising to block climate-hostile federal actions in any way they can. California Governor Jerry Brown's choice for a state attorney general, Congressman Javier Becerra, has promised to use a state's rights argument to block EPA rules, echoing tactics used by Republicans to block various initiatives during President Obama's tenure. Environment advocates say California will continue to be an international player in climate change. Ann Nottoff is the California Director for the National Resources Defense Council.
Now, here in California, and actually in Oregon and Washington as well, we have a Pacific Coast Climate Initiative, where the governors of all three states, along with British Columbia, have signed statements and executed their own program.
California can't join the UN process because it's not a nation, but it has a lot of bilateral commitments to work with other countries and other regions.
Julia Forgy is an Emmett Frankel Fellow in Environmental Policy at the UCLA School of Law. She says one of California's bilateral commitments is to the Under 2 Coalition. That's a group of 165 subnational governments which have agreed to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions to net zero by 2050. And she says AGs in California and in other states can use the courts to slow walk federal changes that would impact their states.
At the state level, the AG should ensure that any legislation and any regulations coming out of California are really bulletproof and won't be susceptible to any sort of federal preemption arguments or any dormant commerce clause concerns, because those are two things that have, I guess, set back some of the California regulations.
The dormant commerce clause means a state cannot discriminate against or unduly burden interstate commerce. Governor Brown is trying a preemptive approach to oil drilling. Tuesday, he asked President Obama to issue a permanent moratorium on new drilling leases off the California coast before he steps down. Local municipalities are also taking a stand. Last month, 35 self-described climate mayors sent a letter to Trump urging climate action and support for city-based initiatives. But that doesn't mean they're expecting a response. Ann Nothoff says mayors, along with governors, can be a front line against hostile federal actions. She points out that even though there could be more oil and gas leasing on federal land, local governments do have options.
They could be up against federal land, but what happens on private land next to the federal land can often have an impact on the direction of federal land management as well.
At the grassroots level, activists say they'll be very busy, not only on climate change, but on local issues like air quality and water safety.
What this election does is it wakes up individuals to realize that government doesn't necessarily take care of them, that they're actually in charge of the narratives of their government, and so they have to be vocal.
Leah Garland is on the steering committee of the grassroots environmental nonprofit SoCal 350. She says knowing local politicians, knowing what issues are at stake, and even how to show up at city council meetings, all of those things matter just as much as voting for environmentally friendly politicians.
Consequently, since the election, many people who in the past have been just giving money to charity are now saying, what can I do? And that kind of realization that they're not passive participants in our democracy, I feel means that we now have an opportunity to help people become more participatory.
While President-elect Trump's cabinet picks are nearly all staunchly pro-fossil fuel and skeptical of global warming science, climate activists say they are energized, ready to fight, and they have a lot of allies. Larry Buell, FSRN, Los Angeles.
You're listening to FSRN, Free Speech, Radio News, independent, non-commercial media. To find out how you can support FSRN, visit our website, fsrn.org.
Tens of thousands of people have fled Myanmar's Rakhine State after renewed violence in the region. According to Human Rights Watch, entire villages have been erased by fire in recent weeks. Fires, they allege, were intentionally set by the military to destroy Rohingya Muslim villages. Kanikar Petkow has more from Myanmar.
Myanmar fought itself to a new beginning, bringing 5 decades of military rule to an end earlier this year when a newly elected government led by renowned democracy icon Aung San Suu Kyi took office. But some say the never-ending civil war in the country and the number of internally displaced people is proof that the new government can't, or won't, deliver on its promise to bring national reconciliation.
The UN nation is officially using the word Rohingya.
Kim Mong Min is from the Rohingya political party.
The extrajudicial killing
is going on every day. So far, more than 500 have been killed. Thousands of people were missing. 50 to 80,000 fled to Bangladesh. The situation in Rakhine State is very dire.
An 11-hour drive from Yangon, remote Rakhine State runs along a large swath of Myanmar's west coast, reaching north to Bangladesh. While sparsely populated, the majority here are ethnic Rakhine. The minority are the Rohingya, who have never been recognized as citizens by either Myanmar or Bangladesh, and are a stateless people. In 2012, fighting in Rakhine State briefly captured international attention, with Myanmar's government accused of mass killing of the local Rohingya people. Now the violence has spiked again.
This ethnic cleansing going on is a crime against humanity. It's genocide. It's very sad, as the international community, they are reluctant to accept these words because they don't want to lose businesses in the country.
The Rakhine unrest resumed in October when militants attacked 3 border guard posts, killing 9 police officers and wounding 5. The attackers were allegedly Rohingya, and the Myanmar army subsequently began so-called clearance operations. According to a new report out by Human Rights Watch, satellite imagery reveals that 1,500 structures have been destroyed since early October. tens of thousands displaced and an unknown number of people killed. That's Aung San Suu Kyi, Myanmar's Nobel Peace Prize laureate, who spent 15 years on military-imposed house arrest. Suu Kyi is now the state counselor and publicly denies the allegations of renewed government-led atrocities against the Rohingya in Rakhine State.
In the end, what matters is that we are not swayed or influenced or buying into these fabrications.
The insurgency that wrecked Myanmar began shortly after the country became independent in 1948 and are not limited to the Rohingya. The conflicts have been described as one of the world's longest-running civil wars and involved a number of ethnic minorities.
For this moment in the KIO control area,
Konja is a member of the Kachin Peace Network from Kachin State, located on the opposite side of the country from Rakhine, largely bordering China. The Kachin Independence Organization, or KIO, is the militant wing still actively fighting government forces. And Konja says the government has blocked access to humanitarian aid and health workers for months, and many of their villages have also been destroyed.
223 villages were totally destroyed and not possible to return back. That means the villages, the housing, social infrastructure like the church, the school buildings were already gone.
The Rohingya are seeking basic rights as citizens of the country. Konja and other minorities recognized by the government want more. Peace talks in the country began more than 5 years ago. The Kachin people have had a seat at the table, while the Rohingya remain excluded from the dialogue. The next round has yet to be scheduled. Kanika Petkao, FSRN, Myanmar.
Many people across the United States are deeply uncertain about their fate after President-elect Donald Trump takes office, particularly undocumented immigrants. That uncertainty, however, isn't limited to people inside the U.S. It extends beyond borders, including to about 1,400 people currently detained in Australia's offshore immigration detention centers at Papua New Guinea's Manus Island and on the island nation of Nauru. Last month, the U.S. agreed to resettle the most vulnerable of the refugees. But as Georgia Clark reports, the future of the deal is now uncertain.
I'm so tired from questions about our conditions and how they are treating us in this remote prison.
That's Behrouz Bouchani. He's a Kurdish refugee who fled Iran and is currently detained on Manus Island, one of Australia's two controversial offshore detention centres. In April, a Supreme Court ruling found the detention centre to be unconstitutional and ordered it shut down. But 8 months later, more than 900 refugees are still languishing there.
We are in prison without any crime. We have been under systematic torture for 4 years.
Last month, Bouchani was hopeful after the Obama administration agreed to a one-time deal to resettle eligible refugees from Manus Island and Nauru in the US. However, the deal only covers those who pass the US vetting process, which can take as long as 2 years to complete. And details are scant about what would qualify an individual for refugee status, but families will reportedly get priority. The deal was a major victory for the Australian Liberal Party, long critical of Labor's immigration policies that they say were responsible for the 1,200 refugees who died at sea trying to reach Australian shores during their tenure.
The agreement is with the United States. It is a one-off agreement. It will not be repeated. It is only available to those currently in the regional processing centres. It will not be available to any persons who seek to reach Australia in the future.
But according to Bouchani, tensions on the island have reached a new peak since Donald Trump was elected as the next US president.
I have never seen the people in Manus prison like this before. People are so worried about their future and scared about when the new president of America will take office next month. The government didn't tell us any details and we don't know what will happen to us.
Despite years of processing refugees on Manus Island and Nauru, only 24 men have been resettled in Papua New Guinea and just another 2 in Cambodia, with the remainder being offered up to $20,000 to return to their home countries where they fear persecution. Many view Australia's attempts at third country resettlement a failure. Now, patience is running thin for the people still lingering in the squalid immigration camps. Charlotte Chomp worked at Manus Island as a claims assistant when a similar period of tension resulted in an outbreak of violence. She says she'll never forget the day that 23-year-old Kurdish refugee Reza Barati was killed.
They didn't tell us that there was a riot. They didn't tell us that, you know, how many people were injured. All they told us was somebody had been killed, and that's all. Even the next morning when I went out downstairs, there were piles and piles of bloodied mattresses where they had brought the people in to be treated. There was blood all over the concrete. There was bloodied blankets everywhere that had been left from the guys that they had been treating during the night of that riot.
Barati's death was a wake-up call for Australians about the plight of the hundreds of refugees on Manus Island. Chomp is in touch with people still working there and fears a climate conducive to more violence is growing.
It's still so uncertain. And I think given they've been disappointed so many times. Also, I've heard from a colleague, they're just worn down, broken men.
According to Barouz, the Australian government has turned a blind eye to the Papua New Guinea Supreme Court's finding that detaining asylum seekers on Manus Island is unconstitutional. But this, he says, is not the only inequity.
We came to Australia legally under international law and they exiled us here by force. They have treated us like criminals and there is not any justice for us.
While morale is low and skepticism high, for many, the US deal presents an opportunity for Australia to abide by its obligations under the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. But with just weeks to go before the Trump administration takes the helm in Washington, for Nauru and Manus Island refugees, the likelihood of asylum in the US looks increasingly slim. Georgia Clark, FSRN, Sydney.
And that does it for this week's program. FSRN is supported by stations that air our show and by listeners like you. Visit our website to hear extended audio versions and read transcripts of stories heard on today's program. Shannon Young provided editorial services from Oaxaca, Mexico. Robert Packard provides technical support from WTJU in Charlottesville, Virginia. Music in today's show is by Alec via Jamendo.com. From Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram. Thanks for listening.